Welcome back to Runtime AI Security. This is episode 3, and we're calling it Impersonation, Time Bombs, and Legal Loopholes. Last time we walked through the direct routes to jumping the sandbox, abusing a trusted publisher certificate, farming reputation over time, taking over a maintainer account, and compromising a build pipeline. Today we're in the second half of that same attack vector chapter, and the vectors get subtler. Before we start, why does the subtle half matter more?
Because the direct attacks are the ones people already have a mental model for. If somebody steals a signing key, everyone understands what happened. The vectors we're covering today are the ones that survive a review meeting. They exploit the fact that trust systems are increasingly automated, and automated evaluators can be fooled by things a careful human would catch, and sometimes by things a careful human would also miss. The through line of this chapter is that every trust signal, without exception, can be forged, compromised, or manipulated by a sufficiently motivated adversary. Today's material is the proof of that claim across the signals people consider the softest and the hardest.
Let's start where the book does, with impersonation and homoglyphs. What is a homoglyph attack in plain terms?
It's an attack that exploits visual similarity between characters. The example the manuscript uses is the cleanest one available. A Cyrillic small letter A is visually indistinguishable from a Latin small letter A. To your eye on a screen, they are the same shape. To a computer, they are entirely different Unicode characters. So a package name that looks identical to a trusted one can in fact be a completely distinct string, occupying a distinct namespace slot, published by a completely different party.
And that's related to typo squatting, but not quite the same thing?
They're neighbors. Typo squatting relies on the human making a small error, a transposed letter, a missing hyphen. Homoglyph attacks don't require an error at all because the name looks correct. The manuscript notes that package managers like NPM and PyPI have been frequent targets of both, where developers accidentally download malicious packages that look identical to trusted ones. The part I'd underline for defenders is the last clause of that section. This is a distinction that automated systems may fail to detect. If your reputation engine is doing a string comparison or a fuzzy name match, a homoglyph can slide past it and come out the other side classified as known safe.
So the impersonation isn't only the name. The book mentions branding and documentation style too.
Right. The full vector, as described, is a malicious package that mimics the author name, the branding, and the documentation style of a legitimate technology company. The goal is to trick the host's reputation system into classifying the package as known safe. Notice the target there. It isn't primarily the human developer, it's the automated classifier. If your system infers trust from surface signals like naming conventions, logo assets, and documentation polish, then those surface signals are just inputs an attacker controls. They're cheap to copy, and they're the first thing a competent adversary will copy.
Then there's endorsement abuse, which feels like it's changed a lot recently.
It has, and the manuscript is specific about how. The baseline version is that a malicious package includes endorsements from seemingly independent security researchers. Those endorsements are backed by fake LinkedIn profiles, fabricated GitHub accounts, or deepfake videos. So you have a layered fabrication. The endorsement points at a persona, and the persona has a plausible social footprint behind it, and in the video case, a face and a voice.
And the more sophisticated version?
In more sophisticated attacks, large language models are used to generate credible-looking endorsements, code reviews, and security audits from fictitious experts in order to artificially raise the package's trust score. I want to be precise about why that's a step change rather than just more of the same. A fake review used to be a sentence. Now the artifact can be a multi-page security audit with plausible methodology, plausible findings, and plausible remediation notes attributed to an expert who does not exist. That is expensive to evaluate and cheap to produce, and any time the cost asymmetry runs that direction, the defender loses if they're relying on the artifact itself as evidence.
Is there any way to tell the difference from the outside?
The defensive posture the book eventually lands on, and we'll get to the probes properly next episode, is that unverifiable endorsements should be treated as untrusted rather than as positive signals. That's the key inversion. Most systems treat an endorsement as adding to a score. The correct treatment is that an endorsement you cannot independently verify contributes nothing. Not a small positive, nothing. Otherwise, you've built a machine that rewards fabrication, because fabricated endorsements are always going to be more numerous than real ones.
Let's move to the advanced bypasses. The first is time-based trust activation. Walk me through the shape of that.
A time-based trust activation attack embeds what the manuscript calls a time bomb, which only activates after the author has established a long history of trust. The mechanics are straightforward. Initial versions are benign and build reputation over months. Then a hidden update later triggers the payload, specifically at a moment when the host's trust signal is stale and has not been re-evaluated. The attack is aimed at the gap between when trust was assessed and when the code actually runs.
That sounds close to the reputation farming we covered last episode.
They're siblings, and the distinction is worth keeping straight. Reputation farming is about crossing a threshold. You contribute benign code until your trust score is high enough that the host applies weaker sandboxing, and then you push the malicious update. Time-based activation is about staleness. The trust signal may have been perfectly accurate when it was computed. The problem is that nothing recomputed it, so a signal from 18 months ago is still governing a decision being made today.
And the manuscript pairs that with something called trust decay exploitation.
Closely related, yes.
Trust decay exploitation is where an attacker who has already compromised a trusted account delays the malicious payload until the user's vigilance has diminished. So the target there is human attention rather than a stored score. Right after an install, or right after a security incident, people are watching. 3 months later, the same package doing the same thing generates no scrutiny at all. The attacker is simply waiting out the attention curve. Both of these vectors say the same thing in different words. Trust that isn't re-verified is not trust. It's a memory.
Next is governance. The book talks about DAO vote manipulation. How does an attack get laundered through a vote?
If a package is governed by a decentralized autonomous organization, then the mechanism for approving updates is a community vote. The manuscript lists three ways to subvert that: Sybil attacks, bribes, or governance token manipulation. Sybil attacks mean creating enough identities to control the outcome, which is the same primitive as the sock puppet reputation farming we discussed. Bribes are exactly what they sound like. Token manipulation means acquiring or borrowing enough governance weight to swing the result.
And the result looks legitimate.
That's precisely why the book calls it particularly insidious. The malicious update passes under the guise of community consensus. The attack is laundered through a democratic-looking process, and that gives it an appearance of legitimacy that automated systems may fail to challenge. Think about what a policy engine sees. It sees a properly conducted vote with a recorded outcome. Every procedural check passes. The process was followed. The process was also captured. And a system that treats procedural validity as a proxy for safety has no way to distinguish between those two states.
Then there's the one I find genuinely strange: legal protection abuse. An attacker uses terms of service as an attack surface?
It sounds odd until you see the target. The vector is that an author includes a terms of service requiring the user to accept all liability for the skill's actions. An automated policy engine might incorrectly interpret this as a legitimate disclaimer and lower the skill's risk score. The trust signal being exploited is the policy engine's own heuristics. Somebody built a scorer that treats the presence of formal legal documentation as a maturity indicator, as a sign of a professional publisher. So a liability-shifting clause, which is substantively a warning sign, gets read by the machine as a positive.
That's a case where the attacker understands the scoring model better than the people using it.
That's the general pattern in this half of the chapter.
These are attacks on evaluators, not on code. The book's defensive counterpart, which we'll cover next episode, is a terms of service scanner that parses the legal documents to detect clauses permitting malicious actions and then flags them for the user in plain language. Note the direction of that. The clause becomes something surfaced to a human, not something silently folded into a number.
Now, signature verification bypass. This one surprised me because a signature feels like the hard, mathematical signal. How is that manipulated?
It isn't manipulated. That's the important part. The manuscript describes crafting a malicious package that passes all cryptographic signature checks and then hiding the payload in a layer that is not covered by the signature's scope. The examples given are Git LFS, submodules, or content fetched at runtime. The cryptography is doing exactly what it claims. It's attesting to the bytes it covers. The gap is between what the signature covers and what actually executes.
So the question isn't whether the signature is valid, it's what the signature includes.
That is the entire lesson, and I'd make it the practical takeaway of this episode.
Go and ask, for one dependency you actually rely on, what exactly the signature covers. Does it cover the submodules? Does it cover large files pulled through Git LFS? Does it cover anything the package fetches at runtime after installation? If the answer to any of those is no, or if nobody in your organization knows, you have found an unverified layer. The manuscript's boundary model is explicit that any layer without verification should trigger heightened sandboxing. That's a question you can ask this week, and it doesn't require any tooling to start.
And this connects back to a point from Chapter 1, about signatures verifying origin rather than safety.
It's the same distinction restated. A cryptographic signature sits in the domain of integrity verification. Its purpose is to confirm artifact authenticity. Its operational effect is that it verifies origin. It does not imply that the behavior is safe. Signature verification bypass and the SolarWinds case from last episode are two demonstrations of that single point. In the SolarWinds compromise, the signature was entirely valid and the software was malicious. Here, the signature is entirely valid and simply doesn't reach the malicious part. Same conclusion from opposite directions.
The last vector in the chapter is the malicious dependency. Why does the book call that a critical supply chain risk?
Because it breaks the assumption that reputation is attached to the thing you're actually running. The scenario is that a trusted author's package depends on a third-party library that is malicious. The host sees the primary author's reputation and on that basis relaxes sandboxing for the entire application. In doing so, it inadvertently grants the malicious dependency elevated access. The trusted author did nothing wrong. They may have no idea, but their reputation is now the vehicle that carries someone else's payload past your controls.
And the real-world example is EventStream.
The 2018 EventStream NPM incident, which the manuscript calls a textbook example. A malicious contributor gained ownership of a popular package and injected a payload targeting a specific cryptocurrency wallet. What makes it textbook is the transitive reach. Enormous numbers of projects depended on that package without ever having chosen it directly. It arrived as a dependency of a dependency. Every one of those downstream projects had their own reputable maintainers, and none of that reputation had anything to say about the code that was actually executing.
So, if I'm inheriting trust transitively, my whole trust calculation is about the wrong object.
Yes, you've scored the author of the top-level package, and you're running a dependency graph. Those are different things. The book's defensive answer, which we'll get into next time, is dependency trust isolation. applying stricter sandboxing to dependencies than to the main skill, running them in a separate, highly restricted namespace with no network access and no file system rights, and monitoring them independently. Defense in depth, applied specifically at the point where inherited trust is weakest.
Stepping back across the whole episode, what's the unifying claim?
That there is no trust signal left standing. Cryptographic signatures can be scoped around. Reputation can be farmed or allowed to go stale. Community endorsements can be fabricated, including in video and audio. Community governance can be captured through sybils, bribes, or token weight. Legal documentation can be weaponized against a scorer. And transitive dependencies mean the entity you scored may not be the entity you're running. The manuscript's conclusion states it flatly. Every trust signal can be forged, compromised, or manipulated by a sufficiently motivated adversary, which means none of them can be load-bearing for isolation. The boundary has to be anchored not in who wrote the code, but in what the code does.
Which sets up the turn we've been promising for two episodes now.
It does. We've spent two episodes cataloging how a host's policy engine gets manipulated into disabling its own sandbox. The next move is to stop describing the attacks and start testing for them deliberately. The book's framing is that security testers attach directly to the sandbox, the trust verification system, the application, and the policy engine as defensive probes. You treat your own security system as the target.
That's episode 4, Attaching as a Callee, Defensive Probes. We'll go through the zero trust enforcement probe, trust score isolation, the behavioral and anomaly detectors, and the supply chain checks, including the hardware key requirement and the trust boundary fuzzer. Thanks for walking us through the subtle half.
My pleasure, and a reminder that this is a defensive series throughout. We name the vectors so that they can be probed and closed, not so that they can be used. Next time we build the probes.